Well, good morning. I am ready to go. I've had two Americanos. That's me trying to cut back. Hope you're ready as well. I've had a few people ask me what my story is, and so I'm going to give you the cliff notes real quick. I grew up in Buffalo, New York. That's where my family is from. My senior year of high school, my parents moved to Detroit, Michigan. I moved in with my grandparents to finish high school. From there, felt called to go into ministry, so went to college in Missouri, which is where I met my wife. We've been married for 21 years. Now, I know what you're thinking. I look way too young to be married that long, so thanks for thinking that. From college, my wife and I moved to Los Angeles, California, where we worked with inner city kids for about 2 years. From Los Angeles, we moved to Colorado Springs, Colorado, to help with the church plants. We ended up staying there 10 years as pastors. And then in year 10, this church called out of the blue, called Northbrook in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And the first thing I did was I had to look where Milwaukee was on the map. I asked if that was in Canada. Do I need to get a green card? Where's Milwaukee? But through a series of circumstances, we landed in actually Richfield, which is about 30 minutes north of Milwaukee. And we've been there for about 9 years. And in August, my wife and I will celebrate 21 years in full-time ministry. So that's kind of our quick story. If you want more, there's going to be a Q&A session, I think, on Thursday. But that's the rough version. If you've got a Bible, we are going ahead this morning to the Gospel of Mark, chapter 10. So if you got one, I encourage you to turn there. I want to talk for a few moments about questions. I think if we're honest, we all have questions that we would like to ask God. I have met people over the course of my life that has said, you know, Mike, when I die, I've got some questions that I want to ask God. Now, of course, there are questions that I have. I have simple questions like, God, why in the world would you create mosquitoes and ticks? I went for a run this morning, and I had ticks on me. Nasty. Check your kids. Lyme's disease is gross. Why would you make those? I have questions like, why can't the Buffalo Bills win a Super Bowl? It's an honest question. But then there are harder questions. Like, God, why did you allow that to happen? Or, God, why didn't you let that happen? About 12 years ago, my wife and I, we were living in Colorado, which is where my wife is from. All her family is there. And we were living in a home which we sold during the market boom and made a ton of money. So we were building a new house, the house of our dreams. But between the sale of our house and the building of our new home, we had an in-between time. So we moved in with my in-laws. So we moved in with a dog and a two-year-old into my mother and father-in-law's house, which was an interesting story because my father-in-law was a Marine. He's very neat, and we're not. And so we moved in with them for about 3 months. About month two, I get a phone call from the office, and all I was told was, come home now. I got home. There was an ambulance in the driveway. My mother-in-law, 59 years old, suffered an aneurysm in her brain. They took her to the hospital. She was in the hospital for 3 months, never recovered, and at 59 years old, she passed on and went to be with the Lord. My wife's mother was her best friend, along with her sister. Her mother was filled with life and vigor and joy and had so much to offer. We had just given her her very first grandchild. And at 59 years old, her life was taken away from her. And there was the endless months of why. God, why would you let that happen? It doesn't make any sense to me. You might have your own why story, God. Why would you allow this to happen? And you might be thinking, God, when I get to heaven, when I get to heaven, I'm going to ask all of my why questions. And to that I say, I don't know. I mean, maybe there's going to be a question and answer period. Maybe the Apostle Paul's going to have a round table and you can ask whatever question you want. But I would bet that when we get to heaven, we're going to be so overwhelmed with that reality that the questions won't even matter so much anymore. But that's a sermon for another day, because I'm not really concerned this morning with the questions that we have for God, which I think are important. I'm not minimizing that. But as it turns out, God himself, through Jesus, is the master question asker. And when Jesus lived on the earth, Jesus asked some pretty compelling questions. And often, actually more often than not, when Jesus was asked a question, he would answer the question with another question. So, for instance, there's a story in Matthew chapter 15. Matthew tells us that some Pharisees came to Jesus and they said, "Jesus, why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders? They don't wash their hands before they eat." That's why I don't wash my hands. And Jesus said, "And why do you break the commandment of God for the sake of your tradition?" And I can just imagine the Pharisees and their frustration. Ugh. Why does Jesus always do that? Every time we ask him a question, he asks another question. It is so frustrating. In the Western world, the world we live in, we approach question asking from a very logical place. We ask a question, and then we just expect a frank answer. Like a few days ago, my wife says to me, "Did you drink out of the milk carton again?" And I said, "Yes." That's question asking in our culture. Children are master question askers, and they ask us a question fully expecting an answer. Why is the sky blue? I don't know. Ask a meteorologist. "Dad, how do planes fly?" I don't know. Ask a pilot. "Dad, how are babies made?" I don't know. Go ask your mom. They want answers to their questions. However, in the world of the Bible, which was the Eastern world, question asking was much part of a bigger process, more than simply asking. Questions were meant to stimulate thinking. Great questions, quite literally, have the potential to change your life. And Jesus asked some pretty life-altering questions. So today I turn to Mark's gospel, Mark chapter 10, verse 46. There's a story. Jesus is on his way to Jericho. Verse 46, Mark tells us that as Jesus and his disciples, together with a large crowd, were leaving the city, a blind man named Bartimaeus was sitting by the roadside and he was begging. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me." Many rebuked him and told him to be quiet. But he shouted all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Jesus stopped and he said, "Call him." So they called the blind man. "Cheer up, on your feet, he's calling you." Throwing his cloak aside, he jumped to his feet and he came to Jesus. "What do you want me to do for you?" Jesus asked him. The blind man said, "Rabbi, I want to see." "Go," Jesus said, "your faith has healed you." Immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus along the road. I wonder if you've ever been stuck in a rut. And what I mean by that is, I wonder, has your life ever been filled with monotonous routine? You wake up and it's the same old same every single day. You get up at the same old time. You go to the same old job or drive the kids to the same old school or do the same old routine. You eat the same old lunch at the same old time. You come home, you sit on the couch and watch the same old Netflix show, eat the same old dinner, and go back to the same old bed. I'm not talking about things being bad. I'm just talking about things being the same. I wonder if you've ever paused and in some way looked at your life and said, "Wow, is this it?" I wonder, when was the last time you got up and said, "God, it is great to be alive. I can't wait for today." Many adults that I know go years without that kind of energy. We can be loving, dedicated, generous, positive, faithful, good spouses, good employees, good parents, faithful churchgoers, and never feel that kind of energy. Now, while this is challenging for adults, It is not challenging for children. Some children can just run around and say, woohoo, for no reason at all. If you don't believe me, just watch some of the children this weekend. The joy of children often irritates adults because it gets in the way of our monotony, and we don't like it. Much like the brother in the story of the prodigal son, the older brother, we do all the right things, check all the right boxes, but there is still no joy in our hearts. Today, Mark introduces us to a man who has been stuck in a rut for a long, long time, living a life of pure monotony. His name is Bartimaeus. Mark tells us that as Jesus and his disciples were coming to Jericho, there was a large crowd that followed him. Now, this story takes place during the last week of Jesus' life, right before Easter. They're walking along the Jericho Road, which looks like this. This is a picture of the Jericho Road in modern times. It is very dusty. It is very, very dry. The Jericho Road, at the point of this story, would have been a main thoroughfare on the way to Passover, the Passover celebration. There would have been large crowds on this road because people needed to present themselves 3 times a year at the temple. This would have been one of those times, and so it would have been crowded, kind of like Summerfest. Right now, Summerfest is going on in Milwaukee. I don't know if you've ever been to Summerfest. I went one time. I don't like crowds, and the only reason I went was because Dave Matthews was on my bucket list, so I went and saw Dave Matthews, checked that box off, and I never care if I go to Summerfest again because there's too many drunk people, and I don't want to deal with that. So imagine that. That's Jericho, the Jericho Road at this time. There are thousands and thousands of people. There's a man named Bartimaeus. He's sitting on the side of the road, and he's begging. Now, this story is unique because this is the only story in all the Gospels in which the person that Jesus healed is named by his first name. His name is Bartimaeus, and he's stuck in a rut. I would imagine that Bartimaeus gets up every day at the same time. He eats the same old breakfast, goes to the same old spot on the same old road, begs all day, goes back to the same old house, eats the same old dinner, and goes back to the same old bed. So what I want to do for just a moment is I want us to enter the story of blind Bartimaeus. I want you to pretend for just a moment, imagine with me. We're going to put on our imagination caps. I want you to imagine you're blind Bartimaeus, or if you're a woman, blind Bartimaea. I just made that up. So this is what we're going to do. To enter the story, I'm going to ask you to close your eyes. Okay, we're going to close our eyes because I want you to imagine that you are on the Jericho Road right now. Keep your eyes closed, no peeking. It is hot. It is dry. It is dusty. I want you to see yourself there. You are sweating. You are covered in dust. There are flies everywhere. You're blind. That's why your eyes are closed. And because you're blind, you're poor. Now, in Jesus' day, there's 2 kinds of poor. Keep your eyes closed. There's the working poor. These would be laborers who, because of heavy taxation, were taxed by the Roman government. And while they still had some standing in society, they were extremely, extremely poor because they were laborers, heavily taxed. But that was not blind Bartimaeus. Blind Bartimaeus was the begging poor. Your eyes are still closed. Begging poor were begging poor because they had physical disabilities. And because they had a physical disability, in Jesus' day, you were disowned by your family. And as a result, you live under chronic economic despair. You live within the shadow of great wealth, however, because Jericho was the place where Herod had his summer palace, a place of magnificent wealth. But you, Bartimaeus, you are sidelined. You are marginalized. You are a nuisance in the eyes of society. And so there you sit every single day begging in the hot, dry, dusty sun. It is all you know, and it is your only option. You can open your eyes now. Was it difficult to keep your eyes closed? Did anybody peek? Who peeked? A couple people, because I saw you. It was hard, right? Because nobody wants to keep their eyes closed because when we close our eyes, that is a position of vulnerability. But that was like 45 seconds. Imagine that's your life, not for 45 seconds, but for a year, a decade, 2 decades. That is your life, a life of sounds, of touch, of taste, but not sight. That is the reality of blind Bartimaeus. So he hears that Jesus of Nazareth is coming, and he begins to shout, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Many rebuked him, told him to be quiet, but he shouted all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." He heard Jesus coming, and he's desperate. You ever been desperate? You ever gotten to that point of pure desperation? There's nothing to lose. He's shouting Jesus' name. People tell him to be quiet, but he doesn't care. He's desperate. He shouts even louder. Verse 49, Jesus stops and said, "Call him." In the original language, that phrase or that word "stop" would have meant Jesus stood still. The desperate cry of a no-name beggar causes Jesus to stop in his tracks. So they call the blind man. They say, "Cheer up, on your feet, he's calling you." So he threw aside his cloak and jumped up on his feet to come to Jesus. Now that's significant because his cloak would have been his most valuable possession. It would have been the thing that kept him warm at night. It would have been the place where he stored all of the money he collected during the day. He drops it on the ground, leaves everything. There are even some that say it would have been his only garment, meaning he quite possibly came to Jesus completely naked, leaving everything aside. And he comes to Jesus, and Jesus asks a simple question. "What do you want me to do for you?" Jesus, the answer is obvious, isn't it? He's blind. What do you think he wants you to do for him? Give him a Ferrari? But Jesus is doing something intentional, which would have been the practice of a rabbi. He was asking the blind man to reflect on his life and inviting him into something bigger. See, for Jesus, Bartimaeus was not a problem to be dealt with. Jesus is not going to do something for Bartimaeus. He's going to do something with him that will change his whole life. The question that Jesus asks the blind man is the question of desire. What do you want? What do you want me to do for you? Every single one of us in this room this morning have a desire. We have desires. Desires are simply the brain's way of telling us that something is missing in our life. Central to being human is the capacity to desire. So in that moment, Bartimaeus has this choice. See, he could have voiced his desire to Jesus, or he could have voiced the defeat in his heart. He could have said, "Jesus, I'm sick of being here. This blindness has destroyed my life. I have nothing. All is hopeless. This is all I can expect. This is just how it is. Jesus, I just don't know anything anymore." There are some of us that quite possibly have succumbed to the defeat in our heart. Maybe you've thought, "This is my life. It's not bad. It's not ideal. But this is how it's always going to be." That's not what Bartimaeus did. Bartimaeus gave voice to his desire. He said, "I want to see." That question that Jesus asks, "What do you want?" echoes through the hallways of history to right now, Fort Wilderness, week 3. What do you want me to do for you? I believe desire is one of the most powerful forces in the world. Desire can lead us to the life we were always meant to live, or desire can get us into a lot of trouble and lead to profound disappointment. So how then do we interpret our desire? How do we interpret this question that Jesus asked? See, first, I believe desire is a gift from God. There have been some that have been taught a bad theology lesson. We've been taught that because we're supposed to sacrifice our lives to Christ, we're supposed to squelch our desire, we're supposed to sacrifice everything in the name of God and not have any desires, but that is not biblical. Beginning in the Old Testament, book of Psalms, the psalmist writes in Psalm 20, may God give you the desires of your heart. In Psalm 103, the psalmist writes, "Praise the Lord, O my soul, who satisfies your desires with good things." Psalm 145, the psalmist writes, "You open your hand and you satisfy the desire of every living thing." Within every single one of us in this room, our hopes, longings, dreams, maybe even things we cannot even give words to yet. The author, Blaise Pascal, once said, "The heart has its regions which reasons know not of." I'm convinced that desire is the beginning of every spiritual journey. You are here at Fort Wilderness sitting in this chapel right now because you have a desire. However, desire can lead to destruction and disappointment when it gets twisted and turns murky. While desire is the source of our most noble of aspirations, it can also be the source of our deepest disappointments. Because sometimes our desires get confused. Sometimes our desires get twisted. I can't tell you how many people that I've met with that have a deep desire for intimacy, and they don't get it, so they turn to pornography, which is a twisted form of twisted desire. Some of our desires are false desires. You ever wanted something, and then you got it, and you're like, oh, that's not really what I wanted, I guess. It's like the dog who chased the car. You ever seen a dog chase a car? Well, if the dog catches the car, then what? Now what do I do? Maybe you've been in this place and you've had desires. Those desires were met and you thought, oh my gosh, this is really not what I wanted. A lack of checks and balances can turn healthy desires into something that is self-destructive. There are desires that work against God's spirit in our life, especially if they are rooted in ego, selfishness, lust, fear, or pride. And this question that Jesus asked, "What do you want me to do for you?" is not the only place in the Bible he asked it. Gospel of Mark chapter 10, verse 35, James and John come to Jesus. And they say, "Teacher, we want us to do for you whatever we ask." That's a pretty bold statement. "Jesus, we want you to do for us whatever we want." Like, can you imagine your kid coming up to you and saying, "Mom, Dad, what we want is we want you to do for us whatever we tell you to do." James and John come to Jesus and they say, "Jesus, we want you to do whatever we want." And Jesus said, "Well, what do you want me to do for you?" And they replied, "Let one of us sit at your right hand and the other at your left." And Jesus said, "You guys have no idea what you're asking. That's a very egotistical request. It comes from a twisted place. It's selfish. It causes tension within the disciples because when the other 10 guys find out about it, because what they were asking is, 'Jesus, when you come into the kingdom, we want to be number one and number two.' Forget about those other 10 guys, but when they heard about it, now there's this uproar within the disciples. They're all frustrated." See, what can happen is unmanaged desires can lead to a very contentless life. You ever lived in that place of dissatisfaction, always longing for something else? And I've come to believe that most people don't have money problems or career problems or even marriage problems. Most people have contentment problems. I had a friend from years ago when I was in ministry. When I first started out in ministry, I was broke. I didn't get into being a pastor for the money. We were living on, my wife and I lived on nothing. We lived in government subsidized housing. We were so poor, at least according to American standards. And I've met people that have said, "You know, Mike, and we were growing up, we were poor, but we were so blessed we didn't even know it." Well, when I was poor, I was convinced of it. I was certain of it. I was certain we were poor. But I was happy for the most part. I had this colleague in ministry who was as equally as poor as me. And he would always complain about it, though. He'd always complain about how he didn't have any money. He complained about how his cars were too old. He complained about just everything, how his life just, he needed more and more and more. But every single day, in the office, he would walk in with a caramel macchiato from Starbucks, a venti, which is like $5 every single day. If you do the math, that's $1,200 a year. He'd walk in every single day and complain about what he did not have. And I wanted to say, "Don't you see what's right in front of you?" We often spend so much time worrying about what we don't have that we forget to focus on what we actually have. For some of us, it's never enough. So there's this tension in this question that Jesus asks, "What do you want me to do with you?" I was first confronted with this question about 8 months ago. I was at a retreat, a 3-day retreat, The person leading the retreat was teaching on this passage of scripture, and they gave a message about this topic, and they said, I want you to take some time and get in touch with your desires. And they gave us 4 hours to go off by ourselves in silence and solitude. It was at this retreat center. Go off and wrestle with that question. So I went off with this question. I was so excited. And after the 4 hours came back, we were supposed to go around the room and tell everyone what our desires were. And they got to me, and I was like, I actually have no idea. I have no idea how to answer this question. Like, I have no idea what I want God to do for me. Like, I know there are things I want, but they're all very surface. Like, I want $1 million. That'd be fantastic. But that's not really what I want. That's a layer. Like, there's a deeper layer in there. And so I've been wrestling with this question for 8 or 9 months. Jesus saying to me, Mike, what do you want me to do for you? And I still have no idea. I don't know what I want God to do for me. You ever been in that place where there's this kind of unnamed desire in your heart? You can't quite articulate it, but you know it's there. Something is unsettled. You just don't know what it is. Ronald Rollheiser, he's an author. He wrote, at the center of our lives is a fiery energy, a perpetual disquiet, a lingering ache for something we cannot quite name. This question has haunted me for months. I know it's a good question, because that's what good questions are supposed to do. They're supposed to cause us to reflect, think, look deep into our own soul. See, in the case of Bartimaeus, he was able to name it. He said, Jesus, I want to see. That is my deepest desire. We read in this story that Jesus gives him his deepest desire. He heals him. Now, the healing comes with some unforeseen consequences. See, Jesus said to him, go, you're healed, but he didn't go. He followed Jesus. And I think he followed Jesus because now he's got a problem. He can now see, which means he can no longer make a career out of being a blind beggar. His whole life has been completely changed and transformed. Now, while this story has an incredible ending, he gets the deepest desire of his heart. Some desires that we have never become a reality. So what do you do? What do you do when you have this desire and God doesn't answer it? See, if you were to ask me this question 13 years ago, I could have told you exactly what I wanted. 13 years ago, if I was asked this question, what I would have said was, I want to move to Michigan to be closer to my family. All these people here with the last name Belanti, they all live by each other. They're always hanging out together. When my kids were little, I was frustrated that they could not grow up with all their cousins. I would call home and they'd all be together, and we were either in Los Angeles or Colorado and now Wisconsin, still far away that we couldn't be at the regular family gatherings. I did everything I knew to do to go to Michigan. I cold called churches. I sent resumes all over the state. I called denominations, and I got job offers from all over the country except Michigan. Everywhere, Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, Colorado, but not Michigan. I'm like, why is this so hard? Nobody intentionally wants to move to Michigan. Well, why can't I find a job? <laughs> 21 years later, that desire has never been answered. Now, it's faded a bit. The kids are older now. My kids are very ingrained in their school. They love where we live. But what do you do with the desire that you've had that never got met? Because this can press on what we believe about Jesus. Because sometimes what we believe about God is in conflict with our actual life. You ever read the Bible and then looked at your life and said, that doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up. What I'm currently experiencing is not what the Bible tells me I should be experiencing right now. This is why I believe that belief in God is not enough. We must also trust. One of my favorite verses in the Bible, trust in the Lord with all of your heart and lean not on your own understanding, but in all of your ways acknowledge him and he will make your path straight. See, belief for me is not enough. I've gotten this place where not only do I believe in God, but I trust him. I trust him enough that even if my desires don't get met the way I want them to get met, my trust in him overrides all of that. And that to me is a very deep and mysterious place, because sometimes it's hard to trust. As we begin to wrap this up, I want to conclude by giving you three practices. I told you I'd give you some practices. I want to give you some practices that can help you get in touch with this question, because I do believe Jesus is asking us this question today. The first question is this. Create some space in your life to actually get in touch with your desires. Do you ever have time in your life to get off by yourself and wrestle with you? Wrestle with you inside of you. Do you ever get time where it's quiet enough to hear God speaking to you? Do you ever get enough time in your life to simply sit back and wrestle with this question, what do I actually want God to do for me? Because if you peel back the layers, often what we thought was a desire is simply a layer, a symptom of a desire, not the true desire itself. Secondly, like blind Bartimaeus, name your desire in the presence of God. Jesus knew what Bartimaeus wanted, but he wanted him to say it. I want to challenge you to let God meet you in that place of your desire and trust him with the outcome. And number three, arrange your life in such a way that you can partner with God to actually do something about the desires that you have. Because I wonder, who is it that arranges your life? Now, most people would say, I arrange my life, but for most of us, that's not true. For most of us, culture arranges our life. Our children arrange our life. Their sports arrange our life. Their school schedules arrange our life. Our job arranges our life. And everyone is arranging our life but us. We are at the mercy of competing voices. And listen, I get it. Like, my kids are in 5 different sports. They run cross country, play football, soccer, basketball, and baseball. I get it. I understand it. But at some point, you've got to say, the madness needs to stop, because I am in charge of my life. Not all of these things. So who arranges your life? Because most people do not arrange their life to actually get their desires met in the first place. Like, I meet with people all the time in my office at Northbrook. And they say, Mike, our marriage is stuck, and we want it to go from stuck to incredible. We want God to bless our marriage, and we want it to go from being stuck to being incredible. And my first question is, what are you doing about it? What do you mean, what are we doing about it? We want God to, no. What are you doing about it? Like, tell me about the last time you went on a date. That was a long time ago. So what you're saying to me is you want a good marriage, you want God to give you a good marriage, but you want to do nothing about it. Not even take your wife on a simple date, but we're too busy. We've got too much going on. Listen, I get busy. I get it. My wife and I have a date day every single Friday without fail. Every single Friday, and it's glorious. And I'm like you. Listen, I'm busy. I know some people in my church think I only work on the weekends, but it's not true. Like you, I'm busy. I got 2 kids. They're in all kinds of stuff. I got a high schooler. I got a dog. I pastor this church. On a weekend, our church is about 2,000 people. I have 30 staff. I got a lot going on. But every Friday, without exception, my wife and I go on a date day, because 12 years ago, our marriage hit a wall. Our marriage hit a wall so bad that the word divorce was used, and I'm a pastor, right? And if pastors can't do it, who can do it? But we're just people, right? And 12 years ago, we decided, no. This, we stood before the altar. This is our commitment. God, we want you to bless our marriage, but we got to do something about it. And so we began to make some intentional practice. We began to arrange our life in such a way that the deepest desire of our heart could be mentioned. And now, 12 years later, our marriage is better than it was when we first got married. But we arranged our life in such a way that we could partner with God to do something about it. Maybe you say, I want to have a meaningful relationship with God. I just want more of God. How are we arranging our life to have a more meaningful relationship with God? So for a couple of minutes, I want us to sit here together, and I want us to look at this question. I want us to consider this question. What do you want me to do for you? So, Sarah, I want to wrap this up. I'm just going to have a couple minutes of silence. And I want us to sit together in the chapel. And I want us to wrestle with this question just for a minute. And I hope that you don't stop today, but throughout this week, that you hear this question in your heart and in your mind. You hear Jesus saying to you, what is it that you really want me to do for you? And then I'll wrap us up with a prayer. Gracious God, this is such a simple and yet profound life-altering question. I hear that question echo through history. What do you want me to do for you? I know, God, that there are desires in this room because this is a room full of people. Some of us, we know exactly what we want you to do for us. And so I pray, oh God, for them that like blind Bartimaeus, they would name it in your presence and that you would cause deep reflection and that you would meet us in that space. For others of us, we have desires that we can't even articulate yet. We don't know the language to use to express what's in our heart. And so would you help us, oh God, throughout the week to mine those depths. For others of us in this room, oh God, that have had desires that have never been met and it has led to profound disappointment, would you help us to trust you? Would you help us to move beyond mere belief and move into that place of trust? The trust that Job had in the Old Testament when his life fell apart and he said, though he slay me, I will trust him. As we move throughout this week, God, as we look to the scriptures each day, I pray that we would enjoy your creation, that we would enjoy the beauty, but also would we spend time this week with you? Help us wrestle with our own soul. And so would you give us grace and peace today? May you meet us, O God, in the place of our deepest desire, we pray. Amen.